This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hanson in for John Williams. We'll take it till 1 o'clock before we roll on. Elliot Richardson joins us now. He's the president and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council. And Elliot, I don't think it will come as any galloping shock to anyone that businesses in Chicago have to sometimes go through some red tape, don't we all?
Yeah, John, thank you so much for having me. The red tape is prolific. It's expensive. It's too much. It's costly. It takes way too much time. And, you know, small business owners, entrepreneurs, local chambers of commerce and business organizations all agree. We've got to cut the red tape. We need politicians to get out their scissors and really get rid of policies and bureaucratic mechanisms that really stop entrepreneurs in their tracks when they're trying to grow and open and expand a business and create jobs. So, yeah, there's a lot that could be done. We have a package to cut red tape. There's over 25 organizations that have already signed on to this package, and it's time, you know, to stop talking and to start, you know, moving forward on cutting red tape.
For those of us, including myself, who don't run a small business in Chicago, and we say red tape and everyone goes, oh, yeah, it's not good. Like, what's the tangible examples of? Like, what can you actually say that you want to change?
You know, look, let's start with zoning. I mean, for many businesses, the process is too complicated and it's just too costly. So let's say you've got a entrepreneur and he wants to move or she wants to move into a community and their business is not necessarily perfectly zoned. It doesn't fit into the zoning requirements of a particular area, but it's a good business and it's going to be good for the community. The red tape you have to go through a hearing with experts and attorneys. Can you imagine that, John, for a mom and a pop? It's ridiculous. An administrative process would do just fine for most special use permits, maybe not all, but most, and it wouldn't impact the ability of older people to be involved just like they are now. That's one common sense way we can reduce barriers for entrepreneurs. Inspections. I mean, you've probably heard about inspections in Chicago being slow and inconsistent. Let's get some consistency to those inspections and make sure that they're done in a timely manner so a business is not shut down for an unreasonable period of time. Oh, I've got a whole list for you, so stop me at any time.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I think people can identify with some of those things. Obviously, some level of inspections is necessary, though, right? So how do you find the right balance for the red tape you don't like versus the red tape that is required to really run a functional city?
Oh, you're absolutely right. Look, there's got to be protections for the safety, the health, and the welfare of Chicago neighborhood. So it's talking about that. It's finding that balance. It's not necessarily saying something like, look, you shouldn't have inspections or inspections should be lenient. It's more like, let's get them done quickly and let's make sure they're consistent. So a small business owner doesn't have one inspector one day and a different inspector another day telling them two different things, because that's actually not good for the city and not good for safety. And for the welfare of the public. And then there's things like sidewalk cafes. So you know those sidewalk cafes that are so popular right now, right?
Yep.
Instead of having them renew every single year, let's extend that out. Unless there's a complaint from an older person or from staff or something's not going right. So there's a whole list of things. And, you know, it's interesting. During the mayoral campaign, we had Mayor Johnson, then Candidate Johnson, at one of our forums. And he was talking about the difficulty and the time it took to just hang a simple sign over his office before he was the mayor. And it's those sorts of things that can really be taken care of that are going to help businesses open faster without the unreasonable delays.
I imagine the full list of things that you guys want, smallbusinessadvocacycouncil.org. 30 seconds. Are you seeing a willing partner from what was Candidate Johnson to now Mayor Johnson? Is he agreeing with you guys? Are we going to see any of this get done?
You know, the mayor put out a really, really robust package to cut red tape, and there's a lot of really good things that are in that package. I was there when he unveiled it. What we need is we need for things to happen more quickly and to get this thing rolling. So, yes, I do think the mayor is a willing partner on this. We hope he's a willing partner. You know, shout out to Alderman Yancey, who's just signed on to support the small this package to reduce red tape. We've talked to a lot of other alders. The will is there. It's just now making this a priority so that small businesses and entrepreneurs can prosper and really bring the Chicago economy back to where it needs to be.
Elliot, it was great to chat with you. Thanks for joining us.
John, thank you so much for having me.
SmallBusinessAdvocacyCouncil.org. You want to be a boss? Ask yourself that. If you are already, ignore it. But do you want to move up the ladder to be a manager? If you're shaking your head or saying no, you're not alone. Philip Weiss from Seifarth at Work joins us. And yeah, Philip, that doesn't seem to be as attractive as a pathway as maybe it used to be. Thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me, John. You're absolutely right. We've seen a lack of immediate long-term commitment to a workplace. We've seen this desire for more work-life balance, which are a couple of reasons why people are shying away from the management track. But the trend, which a lot of clients are talking to us about, I think also underscores the realization that the management world, the leadership suite, is just not made for everybody. So it's a look in the mirror moment for many employees.
I see what you're saying there. That's interesting. The idea that one of the reasons you want to advance, let's be honest, is to make more money, right? You become a manager, you make more money. But perhaps what you're isolating here is the idea that, okay, well, if we talk more life balance, work-life balance, maybe the sacrifice to get to that next level is not worth the juice isn't worth the squeeze, Philip. Maybe that's part of it.
That's exactly the analysis that so many employees are now making, John. I mean, the finance piece is always going to be there. Can I afford staying below supervisor level? But there's also what you might call the fit factor, which is, am I really going to be comfortable? And will I ultimately succeed in a leadership role? And a lot of employees are looking around and reassessing whether climbing the ladder is really in their interest. And they see other people in their work group who moved up, who then regretted it. And for example, at a software developer client that we now work with, a team member was so intent on becoming a manager just for the cachet and because he was looking for that bigger payday. But he realized that the team meetings being drowned in productivity spreadsheets and the other manager level tasks turned them off almost immediately. So debugging code as opposed to directing people was closer to his heart. And interestingly, John, he was too embarrassed to go back to his higher-ups and say, I want a demotion now. So he ended up leaving the company. It can be far more strategic to think about, can I afford this career path without moving up too quickly?
Chatting with Philip Weiss of Seifarth at Work. Okay, so less people want to move up. Is this a problem for businesses because they have less candidates for that? Or is this a good thing for businesses in that people are almost filtering out themselves whether they want to get up the ladder or not?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both because there will be industries, finance is one of them, marketing is one of them, where they've seen the pool lessen, the pool for upper level candidates lessen, but they still got enough people to choose from. But on the in contrast, John, you look at nursing, where maybe only 10 or 11% of nurses want to be directors of nursing. They're really comfortable, and one reason for that is they're paid fairly well, but they want that direct patient care experience. So we work with an EMT company, and one of their ambulance drivers has been offered 5 promotions over just 3 or 4 years, and she keeps saying, look, it, my heart is with helping people in the moment of emergency, not doing the logistics of assigning people to routes. So it's a clear choice for many people and depends on the industry as to whether the employer is facing a real gap or they simply have a better group to choose from.
Maybe the fact that the people that really know they don't want to do it weed themselves out is a good thing. I do worry about people not putting themselves up for a candidate as a manager because they simply don't know if they want it or not. And maybe I'm not good enough or not. Maybe those are sometimes the best managers, the people that aren't necessarily quote unquote power hungry or doing it simply to get up the next rung. Maybe we are losing some managerial candidates who might turn out to be great managers simply because of a little apprehension.
Yeah, that's a hugely important insight. And a number of our clients have been thinking just the way you described, John. And what they've been doing is talking to people that show potential about the manager roles, and even moving around within the company if there's a better area in which they can move up more comfortably. More conversations between team leaders and employees about what their jobs could look like. But there are those moments, John, where someone says, look, at the idea of, for me, workplace conflict avoidance or conflict management is just like running into the closet and hiding away. Or giving negative feedback makes me queasy. Those people may never ultimately be comfortable in the hard conversation moments that really define many manager roles. So there might be these barriers or firewalls you can't cross over, but you're absolutely right. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You want to encourage people with potential and show them what the job truly involves.
I like that you do identify maybe some lines in the sand where you know whether you're on one side or the other. The idea of having the final say, I imagine that scares a lot of people. The idea of giving negative news to people, firing people. I mean, there are some things where you need to be okay with doing before you make that commitment to apply to move up.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's sort of the pluses and the minuses. The pluses meaning things you might love about your job as an individual contributor, as a staff member. Maybe you view yourself as kind of that solo virtuoso performer, and then you got to realize, well, that's not going to be me if I'm just directing others. Is that a worthwhile trade-off? Similarly, to your point, if you love being on a collaborative team of equals, everyone giving their input without being the one who makes that ultimate decision, maybe manager track is not for you. In other situations, though, people have found that they can still be creative, still be engaged, but also aspire to a position of greater authority, reputation, and financial remuneration.
Oh, we got a lot to chew on there. Philip Weiss, thanks for joining us. Seyfarth at Worth. Take care, okay?
Good talking to you, John.
Seyfarth at Work. I hit the wrong consonant at the end of that word. John Hanson here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. The American dream goes something like this. You pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you get a solid job with benefits, you buy that house, you start that family, and coast comfortably towards retirement in the country's robust middle class. While many might think that middle-income Americans would be living this dream, they are not. Instead, they're living like their lower-income peers, struggling to make ends meet and worried about losing it all. I absolutely just ripped off the lead two paragraphs from Juliana Kaplan's story, because they were so well written. You can find the full story after this interview with our business insider, Juliana Kaplan. Great writing, Juliana. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. I was like, that sounds familiar.
You're like, I wrote all that. Okay, that kind of puts that's a damning look at the middle class, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, depends on who we're actually considering middle class. And if we consider middle class to be an income or an identity, but yes.
Why is this happening? Is this something that's existed for a while, or is something exacerbating the problem?
Yeah, so for perhaps a brief moment a few decades ago, people who were middle income could live this sort of middle class dream, right? This idea that, you know, if you worked hard enough and you were in this middle income, you would be able to end your career better off than you started it and set your family up. We've seen the middle class shrinking over the last few decades. Some people are getting much richer, which, you know, good for them. And some people are also getting much poorer, and that is not very good at all. And so the people who are actually in that middle income bracket now are living more like they are their low earning peers rather than their peers who make more. So while middle-income people hold values that are similar to higher-income people, like they want to shop sustainably when it comes to what they're actually doing, they're living like they're making less.
Is it just simply that what used to be affordable for the middle class simply isn't? Like, if you just line up the dollars of what makes someone middle class now and you compare it to the prices, we're just paying more for nearly everything now than our middle-class counterparts were 30 years ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a huge part of it. And if you think about, too, the things that make you middle class, like an education or owning a house or having good health insurance, those are definitely all things that have gotten a lot more expensive and really weigh on people right now.
I see what you're saying. So it's not only just the things, the goods we buy once we're quote unquote in the middle class. It's the very vehicles and mechanisms that make us middle class is what is more expensive.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure everybody has a story about their grandparents or whoever buying, you know, like a three-bedroom house for $10,000, however many years ago, right? That's obviously not the case today.
Is this then a recalibration? Do we just need to relook at what being middle class is? Do we need to change our expectations, or is there hope that some middle class of yesteryear can be restored?
Yeah, I think that's a good existential question. I think for right now, we need to recalibrate our understanding that people who are middle income are not living like they're middle class. The people who are able to afford this quote-unquote middle-class lifestyle are those who are wealthy. And I think that is an important recalibration to think about. But on the other hand, you do see union jobs coming back, not as quickly as they used to, but ones that do have those really strong benefits and those pensions and all of that. I mean, you look at the UPS strike, for instance, and how much those workers are getting paid. And sort of a bit of a resurgence, as I've covered, in blue-collar work, which has been a traditional ladder into the middle class, but that's still a drop in the bucket.
It's interesting you said middle income earners aren't living like they're middle class. Middle class is starting to sound like a exclusive club almost, Juliana.
Yeah, so I talked to a middle class historian who had this really interesting idea that, yeah, being middle class is basically a club. It's a myth, and it's a very fundamentally American thing, this idea that we're such a meritocracy, democratic country that you can work your way up into the middle class. And that also there's, you know, it's not always the most socially fun or viable to be seen as wealthy. Like, we have some stigma towards that. To be middle class feels almost as though you're classless, that you are this neutral arbiter who has worked your way up to where you are. And that's something that people really cling to, because if that's not the case and these middle-income people are living like they're middle class, which is the case, what does that say about whether things are actually a meritocracy and a democracy and there's an ability to move up?
Is there an angle to this that we are looking back more fondly than it was? Is there a chance that we are glorifying what we thought being middle class was a bit? And today, maybe we're just suffering from the reality that it isn't what we had in our heads.
I think that that's definitely an aspect of it. And, you know, when you think about, too, who was allowed to be middle class, and there's obviously, if you're looking back a few decades, many, you know, people who are not white who are never really allowed to have that experience. And so I think that that's an important perspective to have as well. But on the other hand, we finally have gotten to a point where economically, even though Americans who are Black or Hispanic or historically marginalized are finally making gains in education and making more money, the middle class ladder has kind of rolled up behind them, you know?
Is this a problem that has just really been the last couple of years, or has this been a big ship turning around in the ocean?
It's been a big shift over the last few decades. So, you know, the share of people who lived in a middle-income household, according to Pew, was around 60% in 1970. And since 1970 to 2010, that shrunk down to 50% and has basically held true since then. So, yeah, the shrinking middle class and who actually gets to be like middle-income middle class has been an issue over the last few decades.
Okay. Juliana, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. Well written, and I encourage people to go out to Business Insider to read more. Take care, okay?
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
And it's Juliana Kaplan, Senior Labor and Inequality Reporter for Business Insider. All right, let's do the Wintrust Business Minute. Steve Grzanich, what do you got?
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Ongoing production delays at Boeing have forced United Airlines to take delivery of some smaller jets to help it cover some routes. United has taken delivery of six 737 MAX 9 jets while it waits for the new larger 737 MAX 10. The move means United will eventually take fewer MAX 10s when they're ready to be delivered. United had originally ordered or had options to buy nearly 500 MAX 10s. The airline was supposed to receive 80 this year. Faced with the ongoing production delays, United has leased 35 jets from Boeing rival Airbus. Ascension Health System says its electronic health record should be restored by June 14th. That would be a little more than a month after it was hit by a cyber attack. The health system has restored some health records in some states where it operates, but not all. In Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin, Ascension says it's still using manual and paper-based systems. Providers can send prescriptions electronically, and pharmacy sites are open. Ascension says restoring everything is a complex process that'll take time to complete. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, and with the business of food, hello to Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And we here at the station have played a game every year when the lineup at Lollapalooza is announced. Is it a real band or a name we made up? Well, here's one to consider. The Pork Tornadoes. A real band or something I just made up? The answer after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There has never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Pork Tornadoes. A real band? Here's a man with an answer.
Thursday evening, as a closing event, we have the Pork Tornadoes.
Okay, it is a real band, a popular cover band in the Midwest, but it's not playing at Lollapalooza. It's playing at Porkapalooza, better known as the World Pork Expo.
Absolutely. We've brought live music back.
Doug Fricke is with the National Pork Producers Council, which is putting on the Pork Expo for the 36th year. More than 12,000 people from around the world are expected at the Iowa State Fairgrounds to see the latest innovations and talk about important issues for the pork industry.
Well, this year we're looking at just over 400 exhibiting companies, nearly 700 booths at the Iowa State Fairgrounds, and then we've got just under 60 hospitality tents.
Well, producers ought to be in a little better mood. Prices that farmers get for raising hogs have only recently started to perk up a little. It's been a tough couple of money-losing years for the men and women who raise our bacon.
Yeah, it sure has. So that should help bring some folks out and give them some positive spirit going into the show as well.
One thing missing at the World Pork Expo again this year? Pigs. There won't be any because of the concerns about spreading disease, but there will be members of the Beagle Brigade.
Well, right now, it sounds like we've got two beagles coming, Oscar and Pip.
Yeah, they're part of the U.S. Customs team of dogs that are on the front lines of sniffing out people trying to sneak possibly contaminated food into the country.
They'll be doing a demo of how they search luggage.
World Pork Expo tomorrow and Thursday only at the Iowa State Fairgrounds in Des Moines, and everything you need to know about going is online.
Yep, it's worldpork.org.
From the dairy farm to your belly, it is National Cheese Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Jason Lesnevich joins us now. He's the director of cultural tourism at Choose Chicago, choosechicago.com. It's where we often find out about all the really cool things happening in our city. Jason, thanks for hopping on with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited for this crossover event between the Sundance Institute and Chicago. It sounds awesome, but rewind a little bit for us, Jason. I think a lot of people have heard of the Sundance Film Festival, but don't know anything about where it is and its history. Can you just give us a little bit about Sundance before we get to what's happening in Chicago?
Yeah, the Sundance Institute was founded by Robert Redford. I don't have the exact year. I want to say 1987, but it's about a 40-year-old organization. And they really was started to, you know, nurture filmmakers outside of Hollywood. It's based in Utah, their organization. And they have been running the Sundance Film Festival as well for the past 40 years or so. It is one of the top film festivals in the world. You know, they get thousands upon thousands of submissions. And it happens every January in Park City, Utah, which is right outside Salt Lake City.
Okay, so how does Chicago get involved now?
Yeah, you know, they've expanded their programming out internationally. They have a similar partnership in London and I believe Tokyo. And, you know, we really approached them to have this kind of this first U.S. partnership with Chicago to bring some of their programming, some of their presentations to young filmmakers and emerging filmmakers here to Chicago. And the partnership was formed the beginning of this year, and we're really excited that we just announced the programming for the weekend, June 28th through 30th.
So it's coming up here pretty quickly. So is it like Sundance Light? You see just a few fewer films and some panels, but just generally the same vibe?
Yeah, you know, we're going to have four films that will be screened in Chicago in the Midwest for the first time outside of Park City. With these screenings, you know, they're introduced by someone from the Sundance Institute staff. The filmmakers are on site to answer questions after the screenings with Q&As. Many times they'll even introduce their films. So you get to hear firsthand from the filmmakers or the cast or the producers of these films. And it's a really great opportunity to see films that have not yet been released yet. Most of them do have distribution deals, but these will be the first time they're ever shown here in Chicago.
I also was looking at the price points. Very affordable for people.
Yeah, our tickets are $20 for adults for all the screenings and $18 for seniors or students. That does not include tax. You'll pay a little bit of tax on those tickets, but a great opportunity to see some really exciting films. And then we have a variety of free programming lined up as well. We have three panel discussions programmed with the Sundance Institute staff and the Chicago Film Office, which is another one of our partners on this project, really follows the discussion of filmmaking from creative development. Next panel is around financing, very important for filmmakers. And then kind of that last piece is like distribution and film festivals and screenings. And then the Sundance Institute will present two classes. They'll have a shorts master class led by Mike Plant, who's their leading shorts programmer. He'll kind of go through a master class, show some shorts, take questions from the audience. And then Elise McKinney will be doing a Collabs presentation. And this is really how the Sundance Institute works with young filmmakers and introducing them to some of the programs that is offered to filmmakers.
Chatting with Jason Lesnevich from Choose Chicago. Okay, these screenings seem very targeted to go to the north side, the northwest side, and the south side, too. I mean, they're all over the place.
Yeah, we have our two main venues are the Logan Center for the Arts, which is down on the University of Chicago's campus, and then the Davis Theater in Lincoln Square. A lot of the free programming will be downtown at the Cultural Center on Sunday the 30th, but we'll have some of that free programming at the Logan Center as well. So trying to show each film both on the north and the south side at least once. Our opening film will be shown three times, which is Luther, Never Too Much, a great story about Luther Vandross.
Take us a little bit behind the scenes, Jason. How do you get Sundance to come to Chicago? I mean, what is that an active campaign done by Choose Chicago to seek out these things? Do people call Chicago, pick up the phone and say, we want to come here? Like, how does it work?
Well, yeah, I mean, Chicago is a great market for a variety of organizations. You know, I think, you know, I was listening to the promos for Lollapalooza. You know, C3 also now kind of runs the Sueños Festival on Memorial Day weekend. And so Chicago is a great market for a variety of industries. But yes, these partnerships are formed. We knew the film office had a great connection with Sundance for a variety of projects. We knew they were looking to expand their programming in the U.S., and we jumped at the opportunity to work with them. They're a prestigious organization, and Chicago is this great film incubator and production center for film, and we just thought there was a lot of great synergies there.
I was just going to say, you know, we've really blossomed in our film production ever since films were allowed to start doing it again in 1980, but even more recently with the expansion of all the different places where TV is filmed here too, it just kind of makes sense that we should have a little piece of that pie.
Yeah, and, you know, The Bear, of course, the show The Bear is just, you know, renewed interest in so many people, visitors, and just people that may not even think of Chicago as, like, for film production. But then we want to be known as, we're a great film festival city. We have about over 50 film festivals that run year-round and great programming, and really wanting to raise the profile of Chicago as not only this a film festival city, but film production as well.
Okay, so I'm looking at the title of this, and it's Sundance Institute X Chicago 2024. Am I supposed to say X, or am I supposed to say Sundance Institute by Chicago 2024? Like a 2x4. Okay, we're saying the X.
Yeah, it's really combining, you know, the work of Sundance Institute here in Chicago with some of their films. A lot of the panel discussions will have a lot of great Chicago voices on them paired with Sundance Institute voices. So really showing that connection between our organizations.
Sundance Institute X Chicago.com. Jason, thanks for your time. Okay.
Thank you. Have a good day.
June 28th to the 30th.